Welcome back to Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith.
I'm Andrew Rader.
We got a fun episode today. Andrew has a new book coming out in, it'll be Monday when we put this up. So tomorrow, to the listeners, Tuesday, the book will be out. Isn't that right?
Yeah, Tuesday, November 12th.
Beyond the Known, How Exploration Created the Modern World and Will Take Us to the Stars by yours truly, Andrew Rader. How about that? How you like them apples?
Yeah. If you order it Monday, even though it will be delivered on time. I mean, people are already starting to get them a little bit early, it sounds like. And I know Amazon promises, for example, that it will arrive by November 12th. And it should be sold in bookstores starting November 12th. Yeah.
I personally am signed up. Well, I have the advance copy that you sent me. Thank you again for that. And I'm enjoying churning through it. But I'm personally excited about the audiobook, which you read yourself. That's probably how I'll end up finishing the second half.
Yeah, audiobooks are my favorite. So, yeah, totally. It was so much fun to record the audiobook. It was awesome.
Did you have any trouble pronouncing some of the crazy words in here, or were you pretty familiar with them already?
A lot of them. I mean, more trouble than I expected, actually. I knew how to pronounce the Aztec ones. That's one that Sasha
Sagan
mentioned. But some of the, even just how you pronounce certain words in Portuguese, for example, I don't know how you pronounce Fernão de Magalhães. I guess that's probably about how you pronounce it. Fernão de Magalhães in Portuguese is Fernão de Magalhães, something like that. Yeah.
We thought it'd be fun to have an episode about this book, and we're going to break this into two parts. We've got part one here, and we're going to do part two. The other half of the book we'll cover. And this isn't going to be like super exhaustive. We're just going to kind of jaunt through it in two different parts. But we thought it'd be fun to kind of do like a brief overview of this book is so dense. I cannot believe it. And this is the next thing I was going to say. You should be insanely proud of this work. It is like astounding. Every single page is like, you could write an essay on every freaking page. It's crazy.
Yeah, I hope it's not too dense, but and it's readable. But yeah, for example, Ken Jennings, one of the comments was Ken Jennings, who's like the Jeopardy champion, his quote was, "I learned something on every page." Which is kind of funny for someone who kind of knows everything.
I know, I saw that. And I thought that was such a great review. I hope the review I leave is half as helpful. I just hope that everybody listening to this podcast goes out and buys this book, because it's just dripping with information. If you're at all curious about exploration or human curiosity or even like the progress of technology and trade and communication, this book is a complete timeline of all of that, starting from the exit from Africa and all the migration that takes place afterwards, all the way through, like, it's so detailed about all the, like, about the invention of boats and, like, where the initial boat explorers went and then, like, you know, what people were trading for. It's just, like, I might not be doing the best job making it sound exciting, because you really do a great job, Andrew, in the book, like, making each of these little jaunts through history really compelling throughout, because I think it's like, it's one thing to read a synopsis about a book like this, and it's a totally other thing to read what you've written here. And it's just like, I mean, maybe I'm a nerd, but I'm just like, this is one of those books that I don't want to put down. And I've been bummed that I haven't had the time to read it all in one sitting, because it's just like, I find myself thinking about it when I can't read it. And I'm just like, I just want to sit down and read it. And I haven't been able to finish it, but I'm loving every page so far. So great work, and excited to dig in here and ask you some questions that I've had that have popped up. And then also just to kind of encapsulate what the book is about and why everybody should go read it. Cause it's very impressive and it's exciting and it's awesome. It's just good for educational reasons to read it. So, I do want to ask right out of the gate, how long have you been working on this? How long did it take you to write this?
I guess I've been working on it for about 3 years, something like that. The writing of it itself, the actual writing from ideas, probably took a total of 4 to 5 months of pretty concentrated work. But I was sort of collecting ideas and jotting down notes for 6 months before that. And then, it's been like a year basically of editing back and forth with the publisher and with the actual editors and stuff like that. So yeah, it takes a while, a few years, several years.
I mean, obviously your education is a long time you can't really account for going into this, but like the actual writing, it's funny. I was telling my wife the other day when I was reading it, I was like, because there's the amount of detail in here is insane. Like you even go through, there's one part, I can't remember exactly where it is, but there's one part where you describe the tectonic shifts that would have supposedly created the Noah and Babylonian flood accounts.
So the floods are probably based on an actual flood of the Black Sea where the Bosporus breached suddenly, just like the Mediterranean as well. Yeah.
I was laughing when I was reading that part because it's just like, that's what this book is. It's like, it's a timeline of human exploration and stuff, but there's all these little like side journeys that these little offshoots that are just really informative and interesting. And I was joking to Sarah, I was like, I just like to picture Andrew just like sitting at his computer desk, casually farting this out on Microsoft Word in like 3 hours or something.
It's true that basically I knew all of this stuff in general before I started writing. And it's sort of like the idea in my head because I'm a history buff, but also space and science and stuff. And it's a combination of both. So I knew all this stuff before, but I had to definitely look up the details. So the research was basically in the details. And then I would discover something. Oh my gosh, I never knew that. In fact, like one of the facts in the book that India and Rome have the same dates or have the same days of the week, the same origin of the days of the week, that came from Twitter. Someone on Twitter said, hey, by the way, someone from India actually said, hey, by the way, did you know that like in India we have the same origin names for the days of the week as Rome? And it happened that I was writing about the connection between India and Rome before the fall of Rome, so about 2,000 years ago. And it sort of clicked into place that these places were really connected. And that's one of the things about the book. Yeah, it's about exploration, but it's really kind of almost a history of technology because it's about how exploration created the world by creating the incentives for technological progress. And I think that's the key takeaway is that exploration was and still is one of the key drivers of technological progress. If you look at everything we have today, railroads and cars and airplanes and boats and not so much the computer, although that you could argue maybe is connected to the space race. It's all these things, all these technologies that make us modern came about because people wanted to move around, wanted to explore, and created by the incentives that were created by a lot of the voyages overseas. So it's really just about how I really do think exploration basically created the world. And it also defines what humans are. One of the rejected titles for the book, I think this was this your idea? I can't remember. Homo exploricus? Or was that? No, maybe that wasn't your idea. But you definitely wanted an ape with a spacesuit, space helmet.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was vying for the artwork of this book to be an ape walking around with a space helmet on in the desert. And it didn't happen. I was even volunteering to be the ape.
the British copy of the book, the cover sort of has, it has a little bit of like the progression of man, you know, that like thing where they get ape and then a little bit more upright and then eventually ends up like sitting at the computer hunched over. It's kind of like the reversion back, but it's a bit like that in a sense, the cover, because it has like the human and then the ship and then the space shuttle. Yeah.
I know you're excited to see how the book does, obviously, because you wrote it, but I'm excited to see how it does because I can't think of any other book like this out there. I mean, I can think of similar books that like maybe Sapiens to a small extent, because it's like a timeline, you know, but like, I can't think of anything that does what this book does, which is focus on technology and exploration and communication from the beginning of time and then projects it into the future to like traveling to other planets and colonizing other galaxies and things like that, which is what makes that so cool is you're actually working on, you know, you're a credible person to, you know, speculate on those things and to make projections on those things because of your work as a, you know, working in space and stuff. So it's just like, I can't think of any other book like this out there. So I'm just excited to see what the response is.
Yeah. I think the closest thing might be like Guns, Germs and Steel, something like Jared Diamond, like that. Where it's kind of a history idea science book. So you're right. And with the aerospace engineering, obviously that was a super fun part to write. And I think that's kind of the most popular part with the people that I've shown the book to is like the space and the future stuff. But for me, I'm such a history nerd that I just really love writing history. Almost like, I think I kind of almost enjoyed that part more because day to day I do space stuff, right? So for me, it's like a treat to do the history stuff. And I thought that was really fun. But what's really interesting to me is people were so similar back then to now And you think their motivations were very similar. They knew less about the world, but it's actually really remarkable what, for example, Romans or Greeks knew about the world and knew about India, knew about China. They knew about all the old world. There was this map that I think you pointed out by Eratosthenes, which was 2,300 years ago, that sketches an outline of all the old world, meaning Asia, Africa, and Europe. And it even shows the sources of the Nile, for example, which 200 years ago, Europeans didn't know. They had forgotten, basically. Like, you know, all this knowledge was gained in the ancient world and then lost. And in many ways, there were kind of three waves of exploration. One, when humans left Africa and settled every part of the world except for Antarctica and a few islands out at sea. And then there was kind of the ancient world where Romans traveled to China and India, and Chinese traveled to Rome. And that was all lost. And then there was the Age of Exploration, which is kind of a rediscovery of the world.
Right. And I want to get to Eratosthenes, because that is, so far, my favorite bit of the book is the small part that you spent. If I had to pick one small part so far, it's the bit on Eratosthenes, because I had heard of him before, but never in such detail, and I didn't know what an impressive dude he was until reading this. So I do have some stuff on Eratosthenes, but I guess kind of going in order here, there's a list of things I want to touch on. The first thing that jumped out to me reading this, and maybe this is just because of my upbringing, because I grew up in like a really restrictive environment, but I was really impacted by the part on the Nile River in Egypt and how that kept the people in Egypt from exploring initially. Not only because it was their primary source of life, because it was like the one river in this like vast desert area, but also because of their mythological beliefs that if they ventured too far from the Nile, that they would be immortally in danger as well, and that they might like not get access to their heaven or whatever you want to call it if they died too far from the Nile. So that actually prevented exploration and it killed curiosity for a long time. Kind of makes me wonder, like, do we know anything about, like, did that hold back migration or exploration? Is there any info on that, or did it, you know, did it prevent anything like that from happening for a while?
It's hard to say whether that would have had much of an impact. So the idea is the Nile is the source of life, not only in this world, but basically part of the afterlife. It's a sacred river for Egyptians, ancient Egyptians, really.
Yeah.
So when they died, if they were close to the river, they would get transported down the river on a barge to heaven. Egyptians were actually pretty good explorers, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that Egyptians traveled far into the continent of Africa, a lot further than we would have expected. There's a
couple thousand miles or something you said in the book,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like really into Central Africa. So Egyptians were actually really good explorers, but it is true that they didn't really found overseas colonies or anything like that. Not like the Greeks, not like the Phoenicians. Who we've talked about before, by the way. The Phoenicians are pretty awesome, phonetic and all that kind of stuff. The first alphabet, basically, that is similar to what
I like reading about that too.
But yeah, it's hard to say how much of an impact it had, but it is true that Egyptian mythology might have had some kind of impact on their unwillingness to travel, like into the Western Mediterranean or something like that.
It's just interesting to me because, you know, while I understand the cultural significance of mythology and how efficient it probably is to, like, especially to an ancient group of people, to like encapsulate a practical truth in some kind of, you know, kernel of mythology that sticks with them or like cements it in their brain. Like, for example, it actually was imperative that they stay close to the Nile to like survive, practically speaking. But also, like, dressing it up in this mythological thing, it probably served as some kind of vehicle to help them, like, remember it so that they don't, you know, because it might, maybe it, like, stuck with them better as, like, a mythological concept than to just remember, oh, don't venture too far from the Nile or you'll die. Like, maybe having some kind of mythological thing helped them, like, spread that truth to the masses in the area. But it's just interesting to think that it also, in some ways, kept them, you know, not necessarily from exploring, but from, like you said, founding new colonies or like, you know, conquering new territories. It just it held them back in one way or another, like whatever that actually ended up being. And I just, I don't know. It's just that's just such an interesting tightrope to me because, you know, I see so much stuff like that playing out in modern times too. Like there's so many, I don't know, like you'd call them philosophical ideas or something that maybe have some kind of kernel of practical truth, but you know, people, when they get too hung up on the mythological interpretation of it, it actually has physical ramifications that are detrimental, you know?
Yeah. Well, remember, it wasn't myth to them. It was their religion and they really believed it. You might think today about like stem cell research or something like that, how that has the potential to cure lots of diseases, but it's being held back in the United States, at least for basically religious reasons.
That's a perfect example. Yeah. And CRISPR apparently is like pretty far along in like they have like the ability to, I haven't done a bunch of research on it, but I just know that it's like groundbreaking and they're going to be able to cure all kinds of diseases and stuff. And it's just like, how long are we going to banish that here? You know, it's just kind of insane and sad.
Meanwhile, I think in China they announced that they were trying to make a human monkey hybrid or something like that.
It'll probably look like
embryo.
Me.
Not, on your book cover. They weren't going to bring it to full term, but it was basically. I'm gathering it's kind of like an experiment to do with human like tissue growth or something like that.
Okay, so now let's get back to this Eratosthenes guy because he was really, really impressive. And I had no idea until reading your book just how incredible and important and of a guy he was and how much stuff we're still using of his.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
You described him in the book, or I don't know if this is yours or if this was just like something that he's historically known for, as being second best at everything. Like he had, was known for being like, he had his hands in politics, philosophy, music, the arts, like plays and dramas, and what else? What else
and
was he
involved
with?
All manner of science and geography. His foundational work is Geographica. But yeah, his friends called him Beta, which means
right,
like, which is the second letter of the alphabet.
Second
like B,
best
because he's second best at everything.
Yeah, but you said that he's actually the best at a lot of things.
Right, exactly. Which is kind of an insult, but actually, if you look at his accomplishments, certainly in geography and science, he was one of the top rock stars of the time. He was the first curator, one of the first curators of the Library of Alexandria, which was the center of knowledge back in the day. And yeah, he did science, mathematics, astronomy, poetry, music, political philosophy, history, wrote plays.
Can you name his top five accomplishments in different arenas?
Top five. So he drew a map of the world that showed all of Africa, Europe, and Asia, which was more accurate than anyone else could have done for the next 1,500 years, probably. I mean, in that, he listed probably 50 to 100 cities all over the world, and he established tropics. He established the division of the world into the tropics and the temperate zone and the Arctic zone. So, you know, we have like on a map today on an atlas or a globe, we have the Tropic of Capricorn, Tropic of Cancer. Eratosthenes invented that. Invented latitude and longitude. So
what?
Crisscrossing, crisscrossing the maps with markers. Yep. He,
give me a non-geographical
an algorithm for finding prime numbers. That's like a math nerd thing. He computed ballistics for catapults. He determined. Okay, so the biggest thing he did was he determined how big Earth is and how far
that's,
it is from the sun.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. So the
which
yeah,
is incredible. So what year was this?
It was 2,200 years ago, about 200 BCE.
And he invented dating.
This is the other thing. So you know how we have like dates with years and stuff? We go back to the whole concept of dating. So we're in the year 2019. He invented that.
Right.
Now, he started with year zero being Troy, the fall of Troy, but which is
and he fixed our he was responsible for fixing our calendar to 365 days too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that was sort of tossed around. I think the Babylonians used like 360 days, which is why we have like angles probably being like 360 degrees, stuff like that. So that was already being tossed around, but he basically fixed it at 365, which fixes a bunch of problems rather than 360, because then you get off by 5 days every year, right? And they always fix it. Yeah.
and this is probably the last thing we'll say on Eratosthenes, but the most amazing fact to me in that book about Eratosthenes was not only did he create this ridiculously advanced map that was way more accurate than anything for 1500 years later, but Christopher Columbus actually had a copy. He had access to this map and chose to use a different map for his excursion to the Americas. And for whatever reason, you said he ended up using this other map that rendered the distance of the journey by like one third of the one that Eratosthenes had given him.
So he undershot
his mission.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And then like, and if he had just used the map that Eratosthenes had made, which was correct, he would have known that he landed in a new world and wouldn't have thought he had landed in Asia, and he wouldn't have called the Native Americans Indians.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, yeah, Eratosthenes knew more about geography 1700 years earlier than Columbus did, basically. And Columbus used a different map from 1474 from Toscanelli, this Italian astronomer. And that's why he was so incredibly wrong and thought he could sail across the Atlantic to reach Asia and thought he had landed in Asia. Yeah. But yeah, so the most famous thing he did is measured the circumference of Earth. So he figured out how big Earth is within an error of 10%, which is just incredible. And his actual calculation and his actual method of calculation would have yielded an error less than 0.1%. But he was basing it on a distance estimate that had to be paced out. Possibly literally someone actually just walked the whole distance between two towns in Egypt, one further down the Nile, and he used that to extrapolate the size of the entire Earth, because he figured Earth was 50 times, based on the angle of the sun at two different places, he figured Earth was 50 times the circumference of that distance. So obviously, if you measure the distance wrong, you get an error. But still, he was within 10% of the actual size of Earth, and this is 2,200 years ago. It's incredible.
It's insane. What a guy. This guy's my hero. Okay, so a few generic questions here.
There's all kinds of other cool stuff. Yeah, sorry.
Wait, no, what do you have?
Well, I was going to say there was all kinds of other cool stuff. So the Greeks and Romans, and particularly the Greeks, knew all kinds of things and developed all kinds of, you know, steam engines and robots, like submarines and giant mirrors and all kinds. Like, they had all these crazy inventions back like 2,000 years ago, and they were just all lost for 1,500 years. I mean, they knew way more about medicine. They did dissections, and they figured out how the human body works and stuff, and then it was all just banned as like devil's work for over 1,000
And they almost had trains at one point.
Yeah, exactly. They had
railroads, basically.
Yeah.
And they had steam engines, but they didn't put them together to make trains.
Exactly. Totally. It's crazy. Yeah. Yeah.
It's insane. Yeah, it's just fascinating. What I love about this book is, like, you know, as somebody who's I'm a history enthusiast. I'm nowhere near a history buff as you are, obviously, but like, I'm fascinated with human curiosity and how that drives progress and innovation and problem solving. And I guess I worry a little bit that we're becoming too comfortable as a species with technology. And I just want to see that. That people maintain their curiosity and that we keep asking questions. And I think what's exciting about this book is that it just lays out like the struggles that people faced and how they got around them and why. And I just think it's a really inspiring book. But I've got some like generic questions here that I want to dive into that could go any number of directions. So we'll just see what you say. How did exploration drive technology in your mind?
Yeah, this is what the whole book's about. So it's about the path of humanity from our first exploration, which is leaving Africa, basically, and coming to settle the whole world, and how we got to today. And if you think about humans, we're not native to all of Earth. We're just native to Africa. And we can't live outside of Africa without technology, without at least fire and animals.
Is that right?
Clothing and shelter. Well, think about it. You'd just die of starvation and freezing. You'd freeze. We're naked, right? You'd die. Without clothes and fire and stuff, you definitely couldn't live in Europe during the winter. You would just die, right?
That's true.
So
I never thought of it that way.
We're one of the only... The reason we can... The reason we live in North America, the reason why we're able to settle all of Earth is basically through our technology. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't. We'd just be like this other kind of gorilla almost in Africa kind of thing. So humans, through spreading out and pushing themselves, have always placed themselves at the leading edge of progress, and just trying to go a little bit further creates incentives that naturally improve our technology. And then through that improved technology, we're able to expand even further to different frontiers. And it could be also just figurative frontiers rather than literal geographical frontiers, but we're able to do more. I mean, as you get cars and the internal combustion engine, suddenly that enables airplanes because you now have a power source that can bring, you can attach a propeller to, and you can use that to pull through the air, and you can invent wings and fly, basically. So all these incremental improvements in technology allow us to do new things, and those new things open up new horizons for human achievement.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise. I'm wondering, you know, I know that agriculture, you know, the question was, how did exploration drive technology? But, you know, we had agriculture in Africa before we were doing a bunch of exploration. So it is kind of interesting to think about how maybe those two, how maybe technology, because technology is agriculture, how technology fueled exploration to an extent.
Yeah, oh, certainly. It's an arms race. So you have technology and it allows you to explore. And as you explore, you create incentives to drive your technology further. For example, with Columbus, the ships he sailed to the New World were flimsy coastal vessels. They were not suited to travel for long periods of time in the open seas. They were very small. I mean, think about, we sometimes picture these giant galleons or something like that, but Columbus's ships were smaller than a school bus, basically. They were really kind of small ships and not suited for the open sea. And obviously the navigation methods weren't really there and the food was horrible and people died of scurvy and all that kind of stuff. And they did it anyway, and it was the bare edge of what was possible. But because they went to the New World and established colonies and things like that, it created this incentive to improve technology because, hey, these ships kind of suck. Let's like build better ships to be able to do this more often. But you have to have a purpose. I used to think you could just sit around in a room and kind of invent technologies for no reason, but it doesn't work like that. Humans are basically procrastinators, and we invent things when we need to. And so exploration creates that need to
that's a good
do
point.
Things better, to improve technology. Yeah, I mean, technology always follows purpose. You have to have a reason first, establish a reason, and then you develop the technology to fulfill that purpose. You can't invent a technology for no reason and then find a purpose for that technology. Or at least it doesn't generally look like that.
It's just interesting because, you know, in Africa, you know, you think of it at, what's that?
Yeah. So in Africa, so when we talk about the exodus from Africa with the first humans who settled the world, this was about 100,000 years ago. So it's long, long, long before the invention of agriculture. Agriculture was
totally
about 10,000 years ago. This was about 100,000 years ago. But interestingly, I find it really ironic because I think that you're probably right that the most important invention of all time is probably agriculture. And that...
Yeah, I think so.
Renders us sedentary. So it basically stops us from wandering. It stops us from being nomads, which I think is kind of in our DNA. You know, at the genetic level and just based on our evolutionary history, humans are nomads wandering around in small bands. Agriculture changed all of that. But
oh, you're
at the
first.
Same time, it allowed us to pool our resources and specialize and develop technologies that allowed us to go and explore the world.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say that you don't really see the big civilization boom and the big exploration boom until after agriculture, even though there were several migrations out of Africa before agriculture. It seems like we got a lot more adventurous after we had that safety net of knowing we could just pretty much go anywhere within reason and set up new crops and things like that. So, you know, we're spending a lot of time on this point, but I guess it's just it's interesting to think that not only does exploration drive technology, but technology also drives exploration. And it's kind of like this, it's like a give and take.
Yeah. What's interesting is when I talk about aliens and what aliens would be like, I basically say, I think they would have to be agricultural. I mean, you can imagine some environments that might be super productive that might provide enough food for specialization. But I really think that in order to have specialization, you need something like agriculture. That being said, I think for reasons of communication and coordination, you might need to have been hunters, which is not agricultural. So maybe they would have to be similar to us in that they were formerly hunters and maybe omnivores. I mean, that sort of implies it, right?
Or maybe they then, 3D print like synthetic foods.
But how did they get to that point? In order to get to that point, we're talking about how on a different planet they would navigate this evolutionary chain to come from simple organisms to advanced civilizations. They would have to go through the similar transitions to the ones that we have.
Yeah, probably right. Probably right. So I noticed that, and not just in this book, but in lots of books about exploration and trading and stuff, you always read that spices were a noteworthy item of trade. And obviously some of these spices have medicinal properties and things like that. But I'm wondering, what was it that made spices the go-to trade? Was it just that there were different spices growing natively in different regions, and so people wanted to trade for diversity of foods, or was it something else, or what was it?
It's kind of funny. Do spices have medicinal purposes? I think even today, we sort of, to some extent, think they might. And back then, I think they probably did think that a little bit. I mean, I think it's really prestige. So people used to tell the story that it's rotting meat, so Europe didn't have refrigeration.
Oh.
So the meat went bad, so you would just put spices in to kind of hide the taste. I don't think
this
that's
is how
really
barbecue was invented.
Maybe, right? But I don't think it's...
It is right.
Is that, yeah? But
it's
I don't
true.
Think that's really the case. If you look at cookbooks from the Middle Ages, which are so hilarious, they just mix a whole bunch of spices. There's whatever spice you have in the kitchen and cardamom and pepper and whatever. And there's no such thing as a dessert for sweet and sweet dishes at dessert and savory dishes for dinner. It's just whatever goes. They're so totally different from anything we would cook today. Spices though were a sign of luxury. So if you were in Europe, and I think it's also due to the European competition thing. Europe was divided into all these little kingdoms and parcels of land. And if you were a lord in Europe and you could serve your dinner guests spices, it was a signal that you were rich because they were so expensive. Because they were almost just important because they were a prestige item, right? So, and the Romans had used a lot of spices. And I think it's, in a way, hearkening to times past. And it's Europe used to be strong when we were Rome. So if we have spices, we can kind of rekindle the memories of the good old days, and you can put on a good show, and it's like a party item. And only the rich could afford spices. But it was just the markup on these things, the fact that it's basically just like a plant. It's kind of like drugs in a sense, I guess. But it's basically a cheap plant growing in the ground that gets transported halfway around the world, and the markup is 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times on this just simple agricultural product. And that's why it became important, just because it's this prestige item that you can afford. It's why would someone need to drive a Ferrari or whatever is even more expensive than that?
Yeah. I can see the prestige thing, but on your point that spices don't have medicinal properties, I think that's probably largely true, but you can't discount like turmeric, for example, is a great anti-inflammatory, and cardamom is a great digestive aid, and tea tree, I'm not sure if that's necessarily a spice, but it's definitely a plant that grows similar to a spice. It's also got a lot of antibacterial properties, so surely some people were using some of these plants for medicinal things too, right?
Oh, they definitely were. I think there was what I'm saying is it's probably overstated how much they thought it was actually helping them.
I'm sure they
thought it was for medicinal purposes, but whether it had a strong effect or not, hard to say.
Yeah.
Probably not a lot.
Wives' tales.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Wives' tales. There's a term that should that has not aged well.
Yeah, definitely.
It's funny the things that just slip out of your mouth and you're like, wait, that one actually is quite offensive.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
What kind of contact do we know that there was between ancient Europe and the America, what becomes America? Were there
really
people coming to and from?
So I used to be super skeptical skeptical about this kind of thing, and I guess I'm still skeptical in the sense that I do think there's no evidence for direct contact between the Americas and Europe before the Vikings. But one of the interesting things in the book that I thought about was, so people settled the Americas from Asia, right? Either like walking across land or taking boats down the coast or something like that. And I think it's more likely the boats down the coast than walking across land. But Alaska is so close to Siberia, you can literally see Asia from the continent of North America. You can look across the water and see it. And there's people living there.
Yeah.
The truth is
What's-Her-Face famously said.
Exactly.
What's-Her-Face.
Sarah Palin, yeah.
So Sarah Palin.
You can literally see Russia from your house. If you live in the right part of Alaska, not actually Juneau where Sarah Palin lived, or I guess she was in Anchorage at the time.
Right.
So the truth is there was actually a continuous contact between Asia and North America just through this very narrow area, but still there was continuous contact. And in fact, the Inuit who spread across all of the Canadian Arctic in Alaska and Greenland only arrived really recently, like a few thousand years ago, long after the original settlers of North America. So the idea that North America was completely separate for all of history after it was settled is just definitely not true. And I didn't even know about these ideas before I started writing, but if you look at Polynesian naval technology, the Polynesians set out from Taiwan probably and settled pretty much every speck of land across the entire Pacific. And they found basically every island. Every island across thousands of miles in an area larger than the continent of Africa, basically like a huge, huge area. And they got all the way to Easter Island, which is only a couple thousand miles at most. I think it's 1,200 miles, actually, or something like that, from South America. And then we're supposed to believe that they stopped and didn't go any further. And I think it's kind of unlikely. I think that more likely it'd be super easy to find a continents running from north to south. So I think it's actually likely the Polynesians did at some point in some capacity manage to reach the Americas. It's unclear exactly what that would have looked like. It's unclear whether there's any kind of influence or just like one or two guys accidentally ran into it. But if you think about it from the Atlantic side, I actually think it's kind of plausible that ships from somewhere, from Greece, Phoenicia, from the Romans, whatever it is, may have ended up in the Americas because they're not that far and prevailing currents and winds would have taken them. So it's hard to say, even if it might have been like a derelict ship or stuff like that, because, you know, even pieces of wood, flotsam and jetsam and stuff, washes up on the shore from across the ocean. So it's hard to believe that, like, even a rowboat or something like that, even if there weren't people aboard, there wasn't some kind of connection. Now, we can't say what that would have looked like exactly, but so I'm still skeptical. What I say, I guess, is I'm skeptical about the details, but I think we should be open-minded about the possibilities because I think it's quite possible there was some kind of contact.
Yeah, makes me wonder why, what took it so long for people to settle America? I mean, obviously, who knows how long the Native Americans were here before the Europeans came. And I think there is actually stuff to be known on that, but it escapes me. But it, you know, when you think about how beautiful of a place it is and how many people came so close to coming here, and even people that we know came here before it was settled properly, it just blows my mind that nobody like really set up shop here for a long, long time after.
Well, it took humans. So modern humans first left Africa about 100,000 years ago. And then in order to reach the Americas through Alaska from Siberia, you have to be able to live in Siberia, which means that you need pretty advanced technology, pretty advanced shelters and clothing and stuff like that. And you probably, I mean, honestly, I think, you need to build boats too to get across, because even if you can see it, it's still kind of far. It's like 50 miles, right? So you need to be in the right place, northern Siberia, which is, as you can guess, really cold. So you need kind of advanced technology. Right. And that's why it took so long, really. And it happened about 15,000 years ago, most likely. This is actually debated whether people first arrived in the Americas long earlier, like 40,000 years ago or 60,000 years ago. But
right.
But the prevailing view is that probably the first really big sets of evidence come from what's called the Clovis culture. And it's, they have a whole bunch of spear points that were found, and they were first found near Clovis, New Mexico, which is why it's called Clovis culture. That's about 15,000 years ago. So that's when we think people originally arrived here. It actually didn't take very long for them to get all the way to South America. And you think about it like a walking pace. If you were just walking yourself from Alaska down to Tierra del Fuego, right at the southern tip of South America, like Chile and Argentina, it only take like 2.5 years or something like that for you to just walk that distance, right? Obviously, these people aren't just like, let's head to South America, you know? But actually, it probably only took about 1,000 years for people to get from Alaska to spread out through the entire continent.
Do we know why Native Americans were killed by European diseases, but Europeans weren't killed by Native American diseases?
Yes, probably. So this is something that Jared Diamond talks about in Guns, Germs, and Steel, and it's because basically Europeans had a lot more diseases because most diseases come from animals.
And I thought it might have something to do with agriculture and stuff like that.
Definitely a lot to do with agriculture.
So the Europeans were more immune to it or something?
Exactly. Had developed better immunities by exposure over millions of years, and some people died, but the people who survived were better equipped to had better immunities and stuff like that. That's the main reason. But we do think that syphilis was actually a Native American disease that was brought back by Columbus's crew, or maybe the natives he captured back to Europe, and it caused this mass pandemic in Europe, a mass epidemic, I guess, in Europe, and killed lots of people. So we think that there was one disease that went the other direction. But yeah, it's unclear exactly how many Native Americans were killed by disease, but it's high. It's probably over 90% and possibly as much as like 95%, like a ridiculous amount. There were a lot of Native Americans before Europeans arrived, and European arrival killed most of them. There's some really good books about this. Like 1492 is a really good one, and 1493 by Charles C. Mann. Those two books are really good. 1492 is about, actually, I think it might be called 1491 because it's what happened before Europeans arrived. It's about the Americas before European arrival, 1491. And then I guess it's 1493 is what happened afterwards. And it's pretty good. Both good books.
Another part that I loved in this book that I was sitting in silence in the same room as my wife when I was reading this part. And this part literally made me laugh out loud. And she was like, oh, what was that part? was when you were talking about Alexander the Great's dad, Philip.
Oh yeah.
And how he threatened Sparta when were at odds. And he said, "If I enter your lands, I will destroy your farms, slay your people, and raise your city," or something. And Sparta responded with a simple "if."
Exactly. Can you imagine like sending this note like, "Surrender now, or else I'm gonna kill you"? And If I get to conquer you, I'm going to totally destroy you. And they just said back like one word, if.
If. Yeah. It's hilarious. But he did end up conquering them though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that how that went down?
Totally.
It's pretty ballsy of them to just call his bluff just to be defeated embarrassingly. But there's so much stuff in this, so much good stuff in this book. You should be really proud. I think this is probably... I think we should probably start wrapping it up. We can touch on a couple more things if you want, but we got about 40 something minutes here. So, but is there anything you want to touch on before we wrap it up?
No, we'll talk more next time about the future and future space flight, because the book is a trajectory of humanity. And the first part is about antiquity, sort of before the age of exploration, how the world was first connected. Second part is the rediscovery of the world. So it's the age of up to the age of exploration where Magellan first sailed around the world. Third part is modernity, how we became human, we're already human, but how exploration really drove the technology that made us modern. And you can see that exploration invented so many things, was invented as a result of exploration, like even finance and banking and the stock market and all this stuff. And in addition to, obviously, transportation technologies like ships and airplanes and railroads were invented basically
rockets.
As a result. Rockets. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all the sort of transportation stuff you see around you was really invented as a result of exploration, but a lot of social things as well. And the effect on even art, for example, you look at the Dutch Renaissance and you look at Vermeer, for example, who first decided to portray everyday life instead of having these like religious icons. It was a complete revolution in the field of art caused by the Netherlands, by its overseas connections. And you have like the geographer is the famous one and the astronomer, and you see like a world map on the wall. And it's just because the Netherlands was exposing itself to the world and learning about what was out there, what was possible. So almost every field of science and art, music was touched by exploration. And so the third chapter really, or the third part rather, really covers that up until where we are today with the modern exploration of space. And then the fourth part is about the future and what the future is going to look like and how we're going to get there.
It's such an ambitious book. How does it even feel to have written something like this?
Yes, I mean...
I know you don't like being put on the spot with questions like that, and you don't like flattery and compliments and stuff like that. But you know, you can't read a book like this without like paying credit where credit's due. I mean, it's just like it's insane. The amount of detail in this book is mind blowing. It's crazy. You need. I was actually thinking to myself before we recorded here. I was like, we've been jokingly calling you the fax machine on this podcast, but I think we might need a more descriptive name at this point because it might not cut it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wrote the book that I wanted to read. So for me, it's kind of everything I'm interested in, I tried to cram it in. Maybe too hard. That's why there's all these footnotes, because I'm like, oh, I can't leave that out. That's such a cool factoid, and I have to put it in somehow. It's a little bit tangential.
Yeah, there's so many footnotes on every page. There's like two or three.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah.
But I think it's great.
I think it's great style, actually. Mary Roach did that, and I really enjoyed it. So I thought, might as well include all these interesting tangents. I don't know. Sometimes it's a distraction, but it's also kind of cool. So, yeah.
People don't, you know, I think there's two kinds of people when they read books. Like, there's people who read footnotes and people who don't even think about them and just skip past them. So I think it's fine that it has a bunch of footnotes. I mean, the people who want the extra detail will be happy it's there. And the people who just skip past them won't even notice. And, you know, I think it just adds more credibility to the whole thing that there's, so, it's just like dripping with information. It's just crazy. It's an incredible book. So, you know. Hats off to you, and looking forward to part two of this, to the future.
Sounds good, yeah.
And again, the book is out tomorrow, Tuesday, November 12th. Pre-order it today. I've already got my audiobook pre-ordered. Can't wait to hear Andrew fumble over some really long, complicated words.
Yeah.
I'm sure you got most of them.
Well, they did multiple takes if they got it wrong. And we did have to Google how to pronounce words at multiple times. We're like, how do you pronounce that? Yeah, and no one really knew in the room. There's like a director and
that's
stuff
amazing.
Like that. But they're like, I don't know.
That's amazing. All right, well, we hope you guys enjoyed this. Check out Andrew's book, Beyond the Known, How Exploration Created the Modern World and Will Take Us to the Stars. And we'll be back next week, next Monday. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can do that. I'm at Julian Was Here. Andrew is at Mars Raider. And we hope to have you back next week.
Thanks for listening.